97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
All right, welcome back. Third hour of the show. We're kind of set up for tomorrow as well. Scott Jennings is going to join us. A little breakdown of what's happening on Capitol Hill. Also, the newest member of the congressional delegation from the region, Mary Miller, who's over on the Illinois side. John Pertzborn from Fox 2 is going to join us here at 525. It's almost his bedtime, Sue, because he
works so early in the morning. Oh, for sure it is. I watch him at 4 a.m.
Yeah, that's, you know, I did morning radio for a significant period of time, and the earliest that I ever had my wake-up call was about 2:30 or so, and I was at work at 3:15 several years in Milwaukee. It was brutal.
It's brutal.
My kids were very young at the time, and I would end up going to bed at the same time they would, like 8:30.
Yeah.
And they were like, Aiden was a baby, and Evan was a little older. I'd go to bed, and you just never, ever get used to it. But John's been doing that for a long time. He's coming up 5:25. And also an audio cut of the day before the afternoon is over. Tomorrow on the show, Neil Sosik from the Mighty Pines. The Mighty Pines, a great local band. They're playing the Fox on Friday night. So I thought this was interesting as a way to lead into my next guest, because I played some of the audio in the last hour from Mike Elam. Mike's a friend. I've known him for a long time. He used to work in radio. He's now the St. Charles County Council chair. He's the chair of the St. Charles County Council. Does that make any sense? He's the guy that's kind of running the show there at the County Council in St. Charles. And we got into a discussion in the last hour, in case you're just joining us, about mask mandates and some of the things they've done differently in St. Louis County. But this is what he said. This is one of the points he made last night at this meeting.
I would also point out, and this is me speaking personally, that I think we need to take a broader view and quit looking at everything through COVID spectacles. And I think you need to look at the entire health of a community, and that includes mental health.
Yeah, good tie-in. Stephen Thrasher is a professor at Northwestern University, and he just wrote a piece that I read a couple of days ago in Scientific American that basically said very much the same thing. And Professor Thrasher is with me this afternoon. Hello, Stephen. Welcome to 97.1 FM Talk in St. Louis. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Now, are you, just to kind of set the table here, are you a journalism professor or not?
I am a journalism professor, but I'm actually I'm a medical anthropologist. I have a PhD, and I study virology. And I actually wrote my dissertation on HIV criminalization case in St. Charles. I've spent a lot of time dealing with public health in St. Louis and St. Charles. So I teach journalism students about LGBT studies and African American history and social science, and I teach medical students about how to interact with the press and the public.
Now you're just kind of showing off with all the PhD stuff. And all I do, I just have a Bachelor of Journalism from the University of Missouri. I can't show off like that. But look, you started this piece in a very stark way, and I appreciate your honesty. You says, I've never had as much suicidal ideation as I've had over the last year and a half during this pandemic. So first and foremost, that's a pretty bold statement. Explain what you meant there and what was going on.
Well, for me, I'm a single person, and much of my family of origin is deceased. I had one sister I've written about a lot who was sick for a long time, so I've dealt with health things a number of ways, and I've written a lot about pandemics. But I live alone, and I knew that when things were starting to shut down that this was going to be very difficult when we were being encouraged to not socialize with other households. And so I've spent most of the past year, and I've seen people in warm weather outside. I've, of course, talked to people on Zoom and whatnot, but I've physically been alone in my home, you know, for a year and not had people over for dinner and not, you know, socialized physically much with people. And so it's been a big challenge, even for someone who I've long spent a lot of time alone as a writer and researcher. I spend a lot of time alone during the day, but most of my socializing has happened either in other people's homes or then in mine or out in the world. So it was a very, very, it has been a very, very challenging year. And after having gotten my first shot, I'm going to get my second one in a couple weeks. I felt a lot of the anxiety around that start to slip away as I realize I'm going to get to do things like have dinner with people again and hug people again.
It's a great feeling. And, you know, I've kind of made a crack over the last year. So I'm a guy who just turned 56 years old, but I had another child when I was 50. And I've kind of said to some people, because I have a great relationship with my daughter, that I think she may have helped me survive this pandemic. Not that my wife and I aren't, you know, talking, and but, you know, we both work a lot. But having her to sort of bridge the gap sometimes with that loneliness has been very, very important. And I've thought of my friends who are single and on their own, and even some of my musician friends who I was really worried about, because single, on their own, not able to do their jobs in their livelihood, their passion. And what you said is, you said, look, with the suicidal thoughts, probably weren't practicing putting them into action, but it's just a toll that it takes on you mentally.
Yeah, and sort of what I was trying to do.
These allegations are deeply concerning.
Hold on, this is something that the host does on a regular basis with a piece of paper when I hit my computer screen. So I apologize for that. Go ahead.
Sure. What I was trying to do in this piece was I was seeing a lot of people online getting very agitated around masks, and, you know, wanting to not let go of them when after they were getting vaccinated outside. And what I wanted to do is, rather than sort of yell or shame other people, which just doesn't work and it's not very effective, I owned it from my own experience and really thought about what has been very painful for me over this time and what am I happy to let go of. And as the CDC has been kind of confusing around the messaging around this, but you know, outdoor transmission has never been a big risk. It's a tiny percentage of cases, maybe as little as 0.1%. And these vaccines work really well. And so I would rather not focus on a lot of anxiety of saying, you know, what if I'm outside and the 0.1%, or what if I'm part of the 4 or 5% that could still transmit the virus or receive it while vaccinated, but, you know, still not get sick or die, which is the most important thing. And rather start to embrace that, my risk is going to go way, way down. And I kind of got the idea for this column off of a Twitter thread I'd originally read, where the New York Times had this screaming headline that said millions of people were not following through for their second vaccine shot. And when I looked even in their own story, it was actually 92% of people are, which is a wild success. If you ever study multi-dose vaccine campaigns, you know, you're very lucky to get to 70-75%. So to be at 92% is something to really celebrate.
Well,
so,
and, you know, I'd go a step further. And by the way, I completely agree with you. But even if you go to the J&J vaccine and all the emphasis on that, you might even, you know, mention this. The screaming headline should have been, we've put these vaccines out in, you know, record time, and for the most part, nobody is having effects. And that is an amazing success story.
Yeah, yeah. And what I've been trying to explain, the Johnson & Johnson, I hadn't done the numbers before till I wrote this piece, but if you know, about 7 million people got it before the pause, and they're starting to use it again. And they were looking at 6 blood clots, none of which were definitively linked to it out of almost 7 million shots. If you looked at a control group of 7 million people, you would have had probably about 12,000 deaths at the death rate at that time. So, as a journalist, that's one thing I want to encourage my other journalists to do as well, because there are going to be individual stories we see, and I think we do need to step back and look at, you know, as we go from a pretty big group that got tested in the first place to millions, to tens of millions, to hundreds of millions, you know, eventually you're going to see cases in hundreds of millions, hopefully eventually billions of people around the world. But we really need to, or I want to, really embrace and be happy about the fact that our risk is going way down, and it's going to keep going down the more people that we can get vaccinated. And we should have a sense of joy about that. We don't, and it's going to be hard. Like, it took a while. It's ongoing to socialize people into wearing masks. It's going to take a while to socialize out of wearing it too. And so, I would like for myself to, you know, to feel some sense of relief and joy out of everything that's happened so far, as our risk continues to go down.
Stephen Thrasher is with me. He's a professor at Northwestern University and wrote a piece that we're talking about here from the Scientific American. By the way, you gave me such a gift, and you're not even aware. I had not seen this quote that you included from Julia Marcus, who's an epidemiologist at Harvard. And I've been ranting a lot and have been on the outdoor mask situation. And especially since you cited this, the New York Times had this piece today, it could be as low as 0.1. But Julia Marcus at Harvard says requiring masks outside is, quote, a bit like saying we're going to ask people to wear condoms when they're masturbating because we think it's going to get them to wear a condom when they're with another person. I thought that was brilliant. Thank you so much for that.
You're welcome. Julia is a fantastic thinker. And she has a bunch of quotes that I love. And one she uses around gay sexual health, which is something we both study, is that health is not only the absence of a virus. And that oftentimes our messaging is just very, very focused on illness or on a virus when we want people, their health is going to include pleasure and fun and things that feel good and things that give them a sense of whole personhood. And as you were saying, with having, a young child in your life, I am very aware that I just haven't touched people much in the past year. I haven't had hugs, I haven't had handshakes. And touch is like an important part of our health and of our social well-being. So I'm very, very excited when I can start giving hugs again in a couple of weeks.
Well, and you think about it even in terms of, and I don't know how much interaction you've had with people overall, as isolated as you are, but think about, I have, for example, some friends whose father were in a nursing home in mid-Missouri. You couldn't even, leave the room, and if you were going to see people, it was through a glass window. So,
yeah.
I mean, just the torture of, and these are folks who are on their last days anyway.
Yeah. So I was in particular in warm weather, I saw people more. And as you were saying earlier, I've been very concerned. I have lots of friends who are performers, and I think it's very hard for them. I've been writing a book this year. So in a way, it's not been the worst thing in the world to have time alone. But I've always written in the past, still, enjoying friends and stuff in the evening. But you're right. It's been very difficult for people not to have touch. And so that's why it's been great to have these vaccines and start seeing the benefits from them, make it so that people can enjoy each other more.
So you said you have one shot so far. You're not double vaxxed?
No, I had my first shot, and I'm getting the second one next weekend. But even one of the things I've tried to encourage my fellow journalists to keep in mind when looking at that screaming headline from the Times saying, only 92% of people got both shots. Even the single shot gives you about 80% of the protection from Pfizer or Moderna. And it's had actually in England where they've used that as their rollout. It's actually brought the death rate down quite quickly. And I think other countries, as they get them available, will probably use that because a lot of the benefit comes from that. And that was like kind of the overall point of my piece is this is a virus like other viruses I've studied we're probably going to have to learn to live with and deal with in a compassionate and communal way. And vaccination is a big part of that. Social distancing was at its time and masks were at their time too and can still be good tools. But whenever you get a reduction of like 80%, that's already so much to celebrate. So even the people who haven't come back are still getting that protection. And then there are lots of people, I keep hearing anecdotal stories, and for all I know, it could happen with me too, because I got my first shot with one organization. I am ending up getting the second one with another because it's more convenient to where I'm going to be. And even though I canceled that appointment, I don't know that their internal system is going to say I'm a no-show, for returning back again.
Well, that's a good point, because I had three appointments at the same time rather accidentally, and I canceled one of them. I just didn't cancel the other one. I did cancel, but sure, I don't know. That's actually a good point. Was that technically a no-show? Look, I thought it was a great piece. I really appreciated the recommendation for journalists in particular. As a former Capital J journalist myself, going to Mizzou and as a news director, because I do think it's important to frame these things in different ways, and I think the American public is starved for it. I really do.
Yeah. We really have to see that there's a lot of nuance for that. And we are shifting. The pandemic is not over, as we're sadly seeing in lots of other countries, particularly India. Things are very difficult. But as we are shifting into a new stage of it here, there are ways that we can think about health and risk as journalists that are broader. And I think that people can feel less anxiety and not feel it's all or nothing. Like, we're moving in a good direction overall.
I agree. Thank you for the optimism this afternoon, Professor Stephen Thrasher at Northwestern University. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Take care.
We it's a great piece, and I think that he does put things into perspective there that are necessary. And somebody sent me this. I want to thank the listeners who sent me this because I had not seen it. This is from Forbes. And let me check the date because every once in a while, good thing that I picked the date.
What is it?
Well, because this is a piece about, now I think the research would hold here because we've seen this, but this was actually a piece from last May that talked about how, let's see if we can get updated figures, 42%. I think these are pretty on target. Look, half of the deaths from COVID are from 0.6 of the population, the elderly population. I think if you look at even, 85% of the deaths are from people over 65 or 70. Don't quote me on that. But somebody had sent me this to sort of put things in perspective. I'd have to look at, updated numbers before I cite those. But I think they're similar. I mean, that's something that I think is important, too, to keep into perspective. I mean, the number of people, and this is one of the arguments that it's taking place on Capitol Hill, it's taking place in St. Charles, it's taking place in St. Louis County, about kids getting, some kids are getting COVID, but it's a minimal number, and the kids are healthy, and there, we had something else here. Let's see if I have the, there was another mask thing today, wasn't there, Andrew? Was it on the, was it the Walensky thing on the summer camps? It was on the summer camps, because she was pressed today.
Nine.
The CDC director was pressed today in this hearing about this nonsense about forcing kids to wear masks at summer camp, and she cited her own son, who, sadly, his mom is at the CDC. Bummer for him.
I have a 16-year-old. Every day, every year, he comes home from camp and he writes the number of days until he returns to camp the next year. This year, it got to zero and I told him he wasn't going. I want our kids back in camp. We now have 38,000 new infections on average per day. Last May 11th, it was 24,000. And we sent a lot of kids home and camps were closed. The camp guidance is intended to get our kids to camp and allow them to stay there.
Okay, listen to what she said there. Does anyone, and I don't know if she was pressed on this at this hearing or not, does anyone really think that the number of cases last May was less than right now, where we're at, where we sit right now on May 11th, 2021? There's no way in hell you can convince me of that. The 38,000 number, whether it's accurate or not, I can tell you that the number from last year, the 24,000, was not accurate. They were severely undercounting. And I think at this point, we recognize that. So I'd love to know, what I'd say to Rochelle Walensky as a follow-up, if I was at that hearing, and say, look, I can't believe that you're depriving your 16-year-old son when the evidence that I can cite as a non-medical person and the science is pointed toward letting your son go to summer camp. Not only go to summer camp, but not wear a mask. It's ridiculous that this is the stance from the CDC right now. But even some liberals, and I would hazard a guess that my previous guest was not exactly on my side politically.
Oh, I guarantee you. I've looked it up.
Yeah. 525, 97.1 FM Talk. Audio cut of the day coming up before the end of the hour. Tomorrow on the show, we're rather stacked up. My buddy Scott Jennings down in Louisville. He used to work for Senator McConnell and for George W. Bush. You see him on CNN every once in a while, keeping people sane on there. He'll have some things to say about S1 and some of the other things happening on Capitol Hill. So Mr. Jennings tomorrow afternoon, music journalist Tim Summer, Neil Sosik from the Mighty Pines, great St. Louis band. They're playing the Fox on Thursday. Mary Miller, who is the newest member of the local congressional delegation on the Illinois side. She took the, she won the election for the John Shimkus seat. Speaking of the other side of the river, I think our next guest is an across-the-river person, John Pertzborn from KTVI and KPLR. Pertzborn, how are you this afternoon? Isn't it your bedtime?
Mark Reardon, fantastic. My first time, I believe, on 97.1 FM.
Congratulations. It's history.
I know. It's a big moment.
Now, isn't it kind of like your bedtime? Don't you go to bed at like 5:45? What time is it?
Yeah, I go to bed at 6. I get up at 1:20 in the morning. So, I mean, if you get up at 7 o'clock in the morning, this is like 11 o'clock at night for you.
So that's crazy. And we were talking about this, Sue and I, a little bit, sort of promoting this segment, because we've both been somewhat familiar with mornings, and I used to do morning radio, but never that early, and I never went to bed at 6 o'clock. So what, the helicopter lands and picks you up on the front lawn at what time, like 1:45?
Inside of the compound.
Yeah.
Usually the limo takes me out of the compound, then the helicopter takes me over to Fox 2. Yeah.
Is that when they spray your hair so that it won't move in said helicopter?
A team of makeup artists, yeah. They spray my hair, and then they pat me down, and then they push me out on the anchor desk, and I read the teleprompter, and that's about it.
I never did get used to doing mornings, John. I mean, you've been doing it for so long now. It's just part of your life, right?
Yeah, I've been doing it since, I think, 98. Yeah, I left KSDK for Fox 2 in 98, and the mornings just kept getting earlier, and I thought, If I start any earlier in the morning, pretty soon I'll be doing the 10 o'clock news.
You know, if I remember correctly, the way that I got to know John a little bit is when I first came back to St. Louis in 2006, I was up in Milwaukee, WTMJ, the Brewers and the Packers flagship, and I was doing some overnights on KMOX, so I was working real late nights. And you were driving to work, and you heard me probably talk about Wisconsin, and you have Wisconsin ties, so I think that's where the relationship began.
Yeah, I've spent most of my adult life in St. Louis, but I was born in Madison, Wisconsin. And I left there in 82, worked at a CBS affiliate in Madison and also in radio, and then went to Wausau, from Wausau to Green Bay, and then Green Bay to St. Louis, arrived here in 86.
You do not have any Wisconsin accent at all, though. I don't
think. No, but
not at all.
I used to.
Yeah.
John, I was telling them that you used to do, it was Show Me St. Louis with Debbie Turner. How long ago was that? What years? 90s?
Let me see. Our son was born in 94, and that began in 95. Because whenever we needed a toddler, we'd throw Nick in front of the camera. It was so cute.
Oh, that's
I don't
adorable.
Remember that because I was in Columbia at that time, and then I came here for a brief stretch, but I don't remember you working with I remember Debbie Turner. I mean, she was a student when I was there at Mizzou. And
yeah, then
she Miss America or Miss USA? I can't remember.
I think it's
she was Miss America.
America.
Right?
Yeah.
And she let me put on her tiara once. I don't know. I had to try it. I know it sounds, but I said, you got to let me try that.
Hey,
and
I'm not
she
judging.
She finally built up enough courage to put it on my head.
Well, so what's going on? One thing I know that there's a bit of a tie here, and I did not know that he had left Fox, because every once in a while, especially on the weekends, I'd hear Leland Vitter on Fox. He used to be an intern for Charlie Brennan over at KMOX, and I did not know this. He interned with you guys as well over at Fox, didn't he?
He did, and Randy Naughton and I were talking today. We were trying to figure it out. She thought it was like 2009 or 10. I think it was 2004. And Leland was an exceptional intern. He would come to our morning meetings, and this kid, right, still in college, would come up with the best ideas. And we said in 10 years, he's going to be running the TV station. And he left. He went to Fox. He was at Fox from 2010 until this year. And he has left. He was a foreign correspondent based in Jerusalem, later was an anchor, substitute host, Fox and Friends, which I never see because they're on the same time we're on, America's Newsroom. And then this month, he begins with News Nation, which is on WGN. It's the big national show, and that is owned by Nexstar, which owns KTVI and News 11.
Aha. Yeah, and I can't remember. John, do you remember the name of the anchor who was in, I think he was in Seattle, and I interviewed him last year when they were kicking all that off for News Nation, and they have not had as much success with it as they had anticipated, and I think they're already putting some changes into effect, because I think that the concept was pretty good. Do you have a newscast with no bias, allegedly?
Yeah,
no,
well,
bias, and I think there's hunger for that, but is there an audience for it?
Well, and that's, as journalists, and I'm talking about true journalists, which is how I was trained, that's what you try to achieve. You try to shelf your bias. You know, you try to take it down the road and see both sides and present both sides and let the people decide. I'm always hesitant to say no bias, because everybody has bias. And that's why, you know, you get a good mix of people on both sides of the aisle, and everybody kind of keeps everybody else in check. In an ideal world. And if you go to the cable stations, you go to Fox, you go to MSNBC, CNN, you're going to see all kinds of bias. But that's, local TV does a better job, in my opinion.
Well, I think so, too. And, you know, I think I do put this caveat on, but when I criticize the media, and I have for a long time, when it comes to the liberal bias and tendencies, I extract TV news. Now, I'll put the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in there, especially the editorial board, but I think television news and radio news, you have to have good journalism. And we see example after example of where this is important. I mean, even today, the New York Times digs a little bit, got to give them a little credit, that shows that this outdoor infection rate is far less than 10% that the CDC claimed. It might be even as low as 0.1%. So if you don't have reporters telling us things, the problem is, John, as you know, people really don't have this trust in the media.
No, we're up there with Congress people.
Yeah, that's not good. That's not good.
Oh, dear.
But, you know, I give the public credit. I mean, they look at, you know, oftentimes you'll hear people say, the media, as if we all are in the same mindset. We're not. You have to look at every anchor and every reporter as an individual and decide whether or not you're going to watch them. If you don't like them, you know, some people watch because they don't like people.
Well, that's true.
Other people watch because they do.
Right.
But yeah, we brought up Leland because he's going to be joining us for a short time tomorrow to talk about his new gig.
Oh, that's cool.
And, I think we'll also talk about Missouri Governor Parson canceling the $300 federal COVID unemployment benefits and how people are responding to that, which is very interesting to me.
Sue Thomas, I used to do Easter Seals telethons back in the 80s with Margie Ellisor from Fox 2.
Okay, well,
yes,
that's adorable. And I worked with her for years at Channel 4. And so, I used to do a brilliant segment with John Pertzborn on that Show Me St. Louis. I can't remember what it was called. Wasn't it genius?
Yes, you were a gossip columnist.
Yes, it
really?
Was
and that's
really.
That's when Berger was big on the Post-Dispatch and along comes Sue.
Yeah, we were pretty much on the same level, John. Wouldn't you? I mean, really?
Absolutely.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think
well,
I
that
did
was,
three
that was
things.
A unique
did
show.
You say the word "babe" a lot, like Jerry did. Jerry Berger. Hey, babe. Hey, babe.
No, I didn't.
Hey, John, babe. How you doing?
You know what? I probably should have, Mark. That's belated great advice.
Yeah, that would have put you over the top. He just the late Jerry Berger, we should say, because he just passed away in the last year as well.
Yeah, he did. He did.
John,
hey, Mark, I got to ask you, are you going to take Alexa to the big Monster Jam truck show this weekend?
I'm not. I'm going to be in Louisville this weekend, but I wouldn't be opposed to it. I like to, you know, expose her to as much as possible. I've never taken her to something like that. But she's more into, like, Trolls Live and things along those like Bubble Guppies Live.
I didn't know there was such a thing. That's great.
Well, yeah, they do those things. Well, there used to be that type of thing, and they used to do it at the Fox or the Amphitheater, or not the Amphitheater, but the Opera House. Right, yeah, and they just don't do stuff like that anymore because you can't have it. You know, the great thing about my daughter, though, many great things, is she has taken on the passion for music that her mom and dad have.
Really? Oh, that's great.
Yeah, proud parenting moment. I mentioned this, I think, a couple of weeks ago. She was humming it in the back seat, and I didn't really want to put any pressure on her. And then she finally said, Daddy, can you play Ghosts, which is one of the songs on the new Springsteen record? And I thought, all right, I'm done. My parenting work is over. There's nothing
done,
else I can do to prepare her for the world. She's ready. So I was very proud of that. But
Do you have a piano for her?
Don't. You know, I don't think she's, not unlike maybe mom and dad, she might not have the skill at music, although I wouldn't mind, you know, seeing if she does. I shouldn't say this. I bought a guitar when I was a kid. Didn't realize you had to practice and learn how to play and all that nonsense. I thought it was just going to come naturally. So we'll see where the musical tendencies are, John, as we move forward.
Well,
we're
good.
We're going to get you to bedtime. Bright. How does that sound? We'll get you off to
bed. I'm going
to
bed. I got to get out of my Fox 2 pajamas, and I'm going to bed. I'll see everybody tomorrow at 4 a.m.
Yeah, what time is Leland on in the morning? I'd like to check that out.
He should be on between 7 and 8. How about that for a spread?
I will check it out. John Pertzborn from Fox 2. Thank you very much. Get some sleep. 541.
Thank you for having me.
971 FM Talk. How'd you like to get rid of traffic tickets? Should we abolish traffic tickets?
As someone with a...
to reduce... Well, wait a second. You can answer it. In an effort to reduce, I guess, engagement with police officers. Andrew, you would say yes because you just got pulled over, right?
Yes. As someone with a pending traffic... As the person in the room with a pending traffic ticket, I say yes. We must abolish them now before June 18th, I say.
But... even though I don't like paying them, I mean, if you're driving like a crazy person, perhaps you should be deterred.
I gotta tell you, not in Andrew's case, of course. Driving, you know, speaking of driving like a crazy person, I was on 44 the other day. I think I was heading into downtown, and I was in the left-hand lane. There was a car that was to the right of me, and then I saw this guy coming behind me. And I was going to get over because it looked like he wanted to pass me. He was in a car. So instead of doing that, he already shifted over to two lanes next to me. And, I mean, he swings through this gap that was very narrow, and almost hits me and the other person, but people just don't seem to care.
No, right? They don't. And that's why I'm saying if they got rid of writing tickets in general, I think everybody would, well, but okay, more people would do that.
I feel like those people, they're not deterred anyway.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, here's why I bring it up, because there was a piece that NBC News did about a woman from Chicago, African-American, named Jessica Washington. Now, just the details here are kind of interesting and they're a bit nuanced, but she lost her job in 2006. She moved to Las Vegas for a fresh start. She gets a job with the TSA. She buys a used BMW. The car has a busted taillight and she gets pulled over. She gets a traffic ticket. Now, in the end, she didn't pay her ticket and she racked up enough traffic infractions to owe $4,431 in fines.
Oh,
and oh wait, it's not done yet. Okay, and more than $10,000 in late fees. She had a bench warrant issued for her failure to pay. Now she says it's all because of racism, but at the same time, it's kind of interesting because it does highlight the fact, and we dealt with this post Ferguson and Mike Brown here in Missouri. The aforementioned Attorney General Eric Schmidt, who was on the show, you know, shepherded legislation through to address some of these issues. So you do know these municipalities rely on the money from the traffic fines. So she moved to Nevada. She's received dozens of tickets totaling. Now, you can raise some questions about why she's not fixing the taillight, et cetera. Totaling $4,431, a debt that ballooned to more than $20,000 with additional fines and fees, according to data analyzed by a law clinic that recently began helping her. She's paid more than $11,000, and the volunteer lawyers helped her get some of the fines and fees waived, but she still owes $1,900. And her point is the system is money hungry, and it's hard to dig your way out of that hole. So she's, I guess, amongst thousands of people with warrants out for their arrest because they haven't paid traffic tickets, which some of this is kind of dumb. And going back to your point, Andrew, let me address the racism thing first and foremost, because she says that she's pulled over. The cop says to her, you're going to get pulled over a lot for driving this car. She interprets that to mean she's a black woman driving a BMW. Law enforcement's going to target her. There is a possibility that what the cop meant was, hey, you got a taillight out. You're going to get pulled over if you don't get this fixed. But in your situation from getting pulled over, Andrew shared this story from our building right here on Olive. It was because of an expired tag. Now, my wife got pulled over a couple years ago for an expired tag, and this was in St. Louis County. I think it was in Valley Park. They give her a ticket, and it ended up being a warrant situation. That's dumb.
Wow. Wait, what does that mean?
It was a warrant that was issued because she didn't show up for the court appearance or something ridiculous
that means she didn't pay it. So she didn't pay it, and a warrant was issued.
Should we be issuing warrants for people because of expired tags? Now, I'm all for pulling people over for extremely expired tags in particular because of the insurance issue. Yes. But
no, I mean, I've been in that boat. I've never had that situation. I've always got it taken care of before the court date or what have you. But I have been because, you get a little curious and you ask, like, what happens if I don't show up to this goofiness? What happens if I don't have time to go to a totally different city at 8 in the morning?
You don't. You just pay it.
And they tell you, if you don't go to the court date or you don't pay it before this date, we put a warrant out.
By the way, I am almost completely convinced, and I'm afraid to check on this to a certain extent, that I have a warrant out for my arrest in mid-Missouri because my son got a ticket with his car that wasn't paid. It was registered to me. So I remember during the pandemic getting some sort of notification about it, and I'm just now remembering that I completely blew up. I wasn't going to go to Columbia, Missouri and
you
take a day off.
You don't have to go. You just have to pay it. Just mail it.
But if you want it dropped.
No, it wasn't a situation. As I remember it, when the letter came, the way that it was explained to me is there wasn't that option. Of course, if the option was given, hey, you call, you pay the fine, worry about it. Yes, I would have done it. The letter that I got from the court indicated, it was municipal court in Columbia, that was not an option because the time had passed. Now, let's talk about resources, government resources. What a big waste of time that is. Mm-hmm. Am I ever going to go, and here's what's going to happen. I'm probably going to get pulled over in Columbia when I'm there, when I'm doing something, and they'll drag me in and I'll be cuffed, and it'll be a great story to tell on the radio because there's not a chance in hell I'm following up with this anymore until I get arrested.
Yep.
And then when I get arrested, I think it'll be worthwhile only because of what I do for a living, because it'll be a great story.
It will be a great story.
Yeah, exactly. All right. But you remember that. You may want to clip this little tape because I'll complain about it and something will happen and I'll end up in jail for like 3 days. Here.
Stand by. Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
A couple of options here this afternoon. Let's go with, because I hadn't really decided. I think Ted Cruz, at this hearing in front of the Rules Committee this morning, Senator Blunt is the ranking minority member on that committee, talking about voter reform, which would actually give people like Ted Cruz, if they raise a bunch of money from, not PACs, but just from people who are donating less than $200, they get a 6-to-1 match.
I would receive, under your bill, $24 million. Last quarter, my campaign raised in total $5.3 million. That came from over 127,000 donations. 98% of those donations were under $100. The average donation was $41. I asked my Democratic colleagues, why on earth do you want to give my campaign $24 million?
Good question.
I don't want $24 million of federal funds to fund my campaign. And by the way, this bill would give my campaign up to $56 million. The 24 is just the max for the primary. Your constituents in every one of your states, I'd venture, do not want to give your campaigns or my campaigns millions of dollars of federal money.
Yeah, it's a bunch of nonsense, but let's remember it is the number one priority for Democrats and Joe Biden right now. 5:55, back tomorrow afternoon. Neil Sosnick from the Mighty Pines in tomorrow on the 5 o'clock hour. We'll play some music for you. Have a great night.
Get more at 971talk.com. Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.